John Majok is one of the so-called lost boys of Sudan, who, as children, were orphaned or displaced in the 1980s during a brutal civil war. He was one of the lucky ones given the chance to resettle in America. But now, after 6 years of life, education and work in the States, John has returned to the Kakuma refugee camp, and Jane Little went with him, as we'll hear in half an hour. First, Mike Thompson begins a paper chase that takes him into the dark heart of fascism in the America of the 1930s, as Document investigates the White House coup.
On the 21st of November 1934, the following rather chilling article appeared in the New York Times. It concerns the discovery of a planned coup that could have altered the course of American history. Yet today, hardly anyone knows anything about it.
A plot of Wall Street interest to overthrow President Roosevelt and establish a fascist dictatorship, backed by a private army of 500,000 ex-soldiers and others, appeared before the House of Representatives Committee on Un-American Activities, which began hearings on the charges.
If these long-forgotten accounts can be relied on, I seem to be looking at an attempt to set up a fascist government in the land of the free. A coup that could have toppled one of America's most revered presidents, paved the way for a possible alliance with Italy and Germany, and thereby change the complexion of World War II.
Fascism was seen as an example to be learned from, because it seemed like a quick fix. All you needed to do was get people to shape up.
You could have had a handful of the wealthiest people in the United States found guilty of treason and sentenced to death.
But just what was this plot? Who were the Wall Street interests? Or was this nothing more than a moment of paranoia from a national media not renowned for its self-restraint? Well, the answers to some of these questions may have to wait until I can get my hands on the bulk of the evidence, documents detailing evidence heard behind closed doors by a congressional committee. But I already have the official statement released by that committee when it reported back to Congress. Its members clearly had no doubt that a fascist coup was in the offing.
In the last few weeks of the committee's official life, it received evidence showing that certain persons had made an attempt to establish a fascist organization in this country. There is no question that these attempts were discussed, were planned, and might have been placed in execution when and if the financial backers deemed it expedient.
So, such a plot, backed by powerful people, was waiting in the wings. That much is very clear. But how did it come to this? Well, it all happened during one of the bleakest moments in U.S. history.
They used to tell me I was building a dream.
The America of 1933 was in the teeth of the Great Depression, a time of extreme poverty, desperation, and the barren plains of the grapes of wrath.
Brother, can you spare a dime?
I see millions of families trying to live on incomes so meager that the pall of family disaster hangs over them day by day.
Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
The Great Depression is not called the Great Depression in this country by accident.
Michael Kazin is professor of history at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C.
It was the deepest and the longest economic downturn in American history. As many as one-third of the labor force was unemployed in the early 1930s especially. The core of the industrial economy was all but shut down.
Say, buddy, can you spare a dime?
All of this added to a sense that American society was coming apart, not just the economy. People no longer had much faith in the authorities at any level, economic or political.
Yet the image of those days we've been left with is not social unrest, fascism and treasonous plots, but one of dignified suffering and resilient faith in the American dream. No one illustrated that better than President Franklin D. Roosevelt, whose New Deal reforms promised jobs, pride and fresh hope to ordinary Americans.
I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God.
FDR's New Deal policies brought an increase in public work programs, more help for the poor, and the removal of the dollar from the gold standard. Yet while history remembers FDR as a visionary savior in America's hour of need, some at the time saw him in a very different light.
There were major elements in the business community that hated Roosevelt, and they hated Roosevelt out of all proportion to the scale of the measures that he had actually brought in.
Professor Tony Badger is Master of Clare College, Cambridge, and author of several books on Roosevelt's New Deal.
These were businessmen who essentially thought that Roosevelt was putting America on the wrong road in a big way in 1933, and that it was setting the federal government up as a sort of arbiter and enforcer and intervener in the American economy in a way that they were deeply afraid of.
Such powerful enemies had been made within 100 days of FDR taking office in 1933.
The businessmen were also aware that out in the country there were demagogues who were making really popular, apparently radical-sounding appeals, and they were always worried that Roosevelt was unleashing these forces, would encourage these, what they thought of as crackpots, to wreak havoc.
The right wing in America wasn't going to sit back and let this happen. Although its members were a curious alliance of rich and poor, north and south, they were united by one central concern. America was changing in a way they didn't like. Professor Kazin.
The idea that the government would create jobs, the idea that these jobs would be given to all religious groups and all racial groups was very threatening. And so a lot of people who didn't like what Roosevelt seemed to be doing with the government didn't like it, partly because the very people who were cheering Roosevelt were people who this still majority of white Protestant Americans believed should not have any power at all in government, should be subservient.
American society was fracturing along racial lines as well as political ones, and the right was sensing a new power.
There were insurgencies we could call sort of proto-fascist, groups called the Silver Legion, the Silver Shirts, the Black Legion. Most of these groups were continuing some of the themes of the Ku Klux Klan, and these groups often carried out vigilante violence against Catholic workers, black workers in some of the factories in the North. These groups had great aspirations to become much larger than they were. Some of them had aspirations to imitate what had happened in Italy and was happening in Germany.
It's into this world that the plot to overthrow FDR was born. But who was going to lead it, and how did they think they'd get away with it? I'm hoping the answers lie amongst the formerly secret papers of the Congressional Committee that investigated the planned coup. These, I'm told, are locked away in the National Archives of America, a few hundred yards from the White House in downtown Washington.
Well, this seems to be it, the National Archives Research Center. Fantastically grand building. Like there's strict security in operation here. Airport scanner machine.
Yes, sir. How can I?
Hello. I'm from the BBC. I've got an appointment with archivist Jessica Kratz.
Okay. Hold on one second. Let me give you a call.
Thank you very much.
Jessica led me down increasingly claustrophobic corridors into the heart of the archive.
Oh, this is staff area, legislative records, here, watch your head.
The documents I'm after are from a committee known as the McCormack-Dickstein Committee, after the two men who chaired it.
And so here are the papers, the official committee papers, and they're kind of organized by, you know, this file code here, HR 73A-F.
And Special Committee on Un-American Activities on Nazi Propaganda.
It was established to investigate the activities of fascist sympathizers in the U.S. in the early years of Roosevelt's presidency.
It's a very small amount. Only, what, four and a half boxes for what they did in executive session.
So it doesn't look that much, and there's even less than it looks.
For what the committee investigated and how much testimony they heard, yes, I mean, it's a very small amount.
Despite the paucity of documents, there are some that catch my eye.
Starts with some interesting disputes between
the general and the committee. The chairman, general, you are a retired commandant of the Marine Corps. The most important testimony in these records is from a senior commander of the U.S. Marines, Major General Smedley Butler.
I was in the Marine Corps 33 years and 4 months on the active list.
Major General Butler came before the committee of his own free will. He had, he said, been contacted by a well-connected New York City broker called Gerald Maguire. Maguire met Butler a number of times and slowly revealed his audacious plan. He and his financial backers wanted Butler, a highly decorated war hero, hugely respected by rank-and-file soldiers, to rouse an army of World War I veterans, many of whom were angry that a bonus they'd been promised had yet to be paid. The idea was that the general would use these men to help seize the White House, just like Hitler and Mussolini had used their private armies to bully their way into power. At the time, Butler, a staunch defender of democracy, went along with the plan, but he was secretly appalled. Inside the National Archives, I was joined by writer John Buchanan, who has made a study of right-wing America in the 1930s.
These super wealthy capitalists essentially wanted to pose such a threat to Roosevelt that he would basically step aside. If FDR would not cooperate and step aside, they would execute him, kill him.
Smedley Butler's testimony shows the plot was at an advanced stage.
Maguire said to me, "I went abroad to study the part that the veterans play in the various setups of the governments that they have abroad, like France, and I found just exactly the organization we're going to have. It is an organization of 500,000 super soldiers here in America." "Well," I said, "I suppose you get these 500,000 men in America. What are you going to do with them?" He said, "Did it ever occur to you that the president is overworked? We might have an assistant president." He went on to say that the position would be a secretary of general affairs, a sort of super secretary. He said, "You know the American people will swallow that. We have got the newspapers. We will start a campaign that the president's health is failing. Everybody can tell that by looking at him, and the dumb American people will fall for it in a second."
Now in his 90s, Jules Archer was a young man of 18 when General Smedley Butler gave his testimony. He remembers just how idolized the man still was by the tens of thousands of veterans who'd been under his command.
He was a fantastic anti-war general. He was very popular with the soldiers and sailors. He fought for them, and he fought for their rights. That was one of the reasons he was selected for the plot, because they knew he could raise a paramilitary army of veterans who would follow him because they believed in him.
It was here at the Association of the Bar in central New York City, just a stone's throw from Wall Street, that the case against the plotters came to a head. The chief witness, Major General Smedley Butler, walked up these steps past the giant stone pillars that tower above me here and through the rather elegant doors. Even today, all the officers on either side of me, behind the large wooden doors, are packed with people who are going through today's important legal cases. But back on Tuesday, the 20th of November, 1934, this was perhaps the most serious case the country could possibly have faced. And the room where it all took place is up several flights of stairs in what's known as the supper room.
One of the most important witnesses who came here was Paul Cumley French, a journalist Smedley Butler took into his confidence after the conspirators had tried to recruit him. French had also met chief plotter Gerald Maguire at his Wall Street offices, and he recounted their conversation to the committee.
"We need a fascist government in this country," he insisted, "to save the nation from the communists who want to tear it down and wreck all that we have built in America. The only men who have the patriotism to do it are the soldiers, and Smedley Butler is the ideal leader. He could organize a million men overnight. During the course of the conversation, he continually discussed the need of a man on a white horse, as he called it, a dictator who would come galloping in on his white horse. He said that was the only way, to save the capitalistic system.
But it was Smedley Butler, war hero and soldier's friend, who exposed the plot. He continued his meetings with Maguire until he gathered enough information on the plotters to bring the evidence before the McCormack-Dickstein Committee. But given that there were no recordings of these meetings, or letters written by Maguire outlining his plans, how can we be sure that the General didn't exaggerate or even make up the whole story? Jules Archer, who went on to study the lives of Smedley Butler and Representative John McCormack, is convinced the plot was real. He remembers talking to McCormack about his time as chairman of the committee that investigated the case.
McCormack was a veteran politician. He was an advisor to Roosevelt and other presidents. He had a heavy Irish accent. He told me, "General Smedley Butler was one of the outstanding Americans in our history. I cannot emphasize too strongly the very important part he played in exposing the fascist plot in the early 1930s, backed by and planned by persons possessing tremendous wealth." And there was no doubt about it that McCormack was absolutely convinced that Butler was telling the truth.
"An unauthorized attack on an active movement in the United States. We present Representative Dickstein."
In this early radio archive, you can just make out the other co-chairman, Representative Samuel Dickstein, warning Americans to be aware of the threat from fascist forces from within.
"We have succeeded in unearthing evidence to define the Nazi government here as the most dangerous threat to our democracy that has ever existed."
And the central character of the plot, the plain-speaking Major General Smedley Butler, was caught on early newsreel from the time, explaining his part in exposing the plot.
"I talked with an investigator for this committee. He told me they had unearthed evidence linking my name with several such veteran organizations. As it then seemed to me to be getting serious, I felt it was my duty to tell all I knew of such activities to this committee. My main interest in all this is to preserve our democratic institution."
So Smedley Butler remained adamant that he was the target of a fascist plot, and there was never any doubt either in the mind of Committee Chairman John McCormack that the forces of fascism were gathering to storm the White House. But who was going to fund the coup? Even with the backing of 500,000 veterans, a plot of this sort against the most powerful government on earth needs money as well as muscle, and an awful lot of it too. Well, according to Smedley Butler, this was where the big business moguls and Wall Street brokers behind the coup came in. They, he was told by Maguire, would soon step out of the shadows in the form of a newly created lobby group. Soon after he made this promise to Butler, the American Liberty League was born. John Buchanan.
Maguire said, "Well, you're going to see in the next few weeks in the press, this organization is going to be created that's going to front for the whole thing, and we're going to stand up for the Constitution, and we're going to stand up for our troops and so on." And lo and behold, about 2 weeks later, splashed all over the major newspapers of the time, especially in New York and Washington, the creation of the American Liberty League.
To get a flavor of the ideology that motivated the Liberty League, here's one of their leading supporters, Demarest Lloyd, writing in his magazine, Affairs.
"Popular government is a perilous extravagance in time of emergency. The present situation is more destructive than war, and much more difficult for a popular government to handle. It is quite apparent that unless confusion is to become chaos, Congress, like a long line of unfit rulers in the past, should abdicate."
It's a matter of record that the membership of the American Liberty League included some of the most famous names in business. Its benefactors read like a who's who of household products that are still familiar today. General Foods, the makers of Maxwell House coffee, Bird's Eye and Colgate, Heinz Foods, US Steel and car manufacturer General Motors were all supporters of the League.
These are industrial individual titans of industry, and they talked to each other and they wound each other up into ever-increasing frenzy and denunciation of the men in the White House. They become quite a fevered, conspiracy-oriented group of individuals. They are the people who go on to form the American Liberty League.
The treasurer of this organization was the broker Grayson Murphy. A little research has revealed that he was none other than the boss of the man at the center of the plot allegations, Gerald Maguire. Later in the McCormack-Dickstein report, a shipping company called Hamburg America Line was accused of providing free passage to Germany to American journalists willing to write favourable copy on Hitler's rise to power. The company is also alleged to have brought Nazi spies and pro-fascist sympathisers into America. John Buchanan has studied this later section of the report and has discovered that one of the company's managers came from a very famous family.
The thing that surprised me most was to discover in the documents that this company, Hamburg America Lines, had in fact been managed on the U.S. side at the executive level by Prescott Bush as part of a web of Nazi business interests that were all seized in late 1942 under the Trading with the Enemy Act by the U.S. Congress. And Prescott Bush is the grandfather of the sitting president of the United States.
Of course, at the time, it was perfectly legal to have dealings with Hitler's Germany. Prescott Bush was not called to account for this until America entered the war. Neither was it a crime to be a member of a lobby group like the Liberty League, and I found no firm evidence that the Liberty League itself was behind the plot to overthrow their country's democratically elected president. But academics like Professor Tony Badger believes that it was, at the very least, a magnet for those with such intentions.
It would always surprise me if they had been really, there had been a lot of very fine-tuned planning. But the sense that forces that might be unleashed by the New Deal pose such a threat that desperate measures might be needed does ring true.
But yet again, the evidence is hard to find. You'd have thought that if there was any linking leading American industrialists of the day to a plot against the president, I'd be able to find it at the National Archives in Washington. Yet when John Buchanan and I leafed through the rather thin files there, we found no direct reference to any of these people. Though I'm now starting to wonder whether any such evidence has been removed or deliberately withheld from the records in the first place. General Butler seemed to have harboured similar suspicions. After the investigating committee published its findings, he accused its members of deliberately editing out of his testimony the names of top business people who he had linked to the plot. On the 17th of February 1935, just after the committee had published its findings, he had this to say on Radio WCAU.
Like most committees, it has slaughtered the little and allowed the big to escape. The big shots weren't even called to testify. They were all mentioned in the testimony. Why was all mention of these names suppressed from the testimony?
The co-chairman, Samuel Dickstein, admits that the papers were censored, but insisted that this was for a very good reason.
The testimony given by General Butler was kept confidential until such time as the names of the persons who were mentioned could be checked upon and verified. This accounts for the fact that when the results of the hearings were made public, references were omitted.
That argument would have seemed fair enough if names had later been checked and verified. Yet most of the senior figures implicated in General Smedley Butler's evidence were never asked to appear before the committee to answer the questions raised. Even though, had the allegations against them been found to be true, people like Irene DuPont and banker J.P. Morgan could have faced the death sentence for treason.
The investigations mysteriously turn to vapor when it comes time to call them to testify. FDR's main interest was getting the New Deal passed. And so he struck a deal in which it was agreed that the plotters would walk free if Wall Street would back off of their opposition to the New Deal and let FDR do what he wanted.
John Buchanan. With their cover blown, it seems likely that the plotters and their wealthy backers had little option but to accept such a deal and return to the business they knew best, making money. But what chance would such a coup have had anyway? Even with millions of dollars and 500,000 veterans at their disposal, could the plotters ever have pulled it off against the armed forces of a great power like the US? Well, according to Professor Tony Badger, back then it might not have been quite as difficult as it now seems.
The American army was anything but powerful in 1933. The peacetime army had been reduced to, 120,000-130,000, scattered all over the United States. It was a depressing and soul-destroying business being an army officer in the United States in the 1920s and 1930s. So I think the sense that the American army as such was a powerful group that could have put down any trouble, it has to be seen in that context.
Though Professor William Becker of George Washington University insists that defeating the Federal Army would only be the first of many big challenges still facing the coup leaders.
I just remain extremely skeptical about this because the U.S. government was, in fact, very, very decentralized. When one talks about, you know, seizing power, I just think it would be extremely difficult given the decentralized nature of the government. There would have been enormous resistance to that.
Professor William Becker. Perhaps the biggest remaining question is whether, had the coup gone ahead and been successful, the American people would ever have put up with a dictator in the White House. It seems unlikely. After all, this is a nation that describes itself as the land of the free, the home of democracy. But Professor Michael Kazin is not quite so dismissive. He believes that if we today are ready to accept the loss of some of our liberties in return for personal security, might Americans of the Great Depression have been just as ready to sacrifice some of their freedoms for food, jobs, and financial security?
People wanted security. I mean, the key word in the 30s, as now for that matter, was security. Social security, of course, health security. And Americans, I think, in the 30s cared more about security than they did about democracy. And so if a group of businessmen, with the help of some people, former military people or current military people, could have fairly quickly brought the economy back, created the sense of security, then yes, it is possible that they would have gotten some popular support.
America would have become a dictatorship. Democracy would be gone. America would have joined Hitler and Mussolini as a fascist triumphant.
Document, The White House Coup, was presented by Mike Thompson. The readers were Peter Marinka and Kerry Shale, and the producer was Philip Sellers. If you have any stories that you would like the document team to follow up, you can get in touch via the Radio 4 website. Well, in this week's Crossing Continents, Jane Little travels with one of the so-called Lost Boys of Sudan as he meets his mother and the girl he's due to marry. But can there be a happy ending for John and his new wife? Find out in a moment.
In 1947, a line was drawn which partitioned India. What followed was mass migration as Hindus and Sikhs fled from the newly formed Pakistan and Muslims fled from India. 60 years on, BBC Radio 4 will be exploring the legacy of partition with a series of programmes which include personal stories, fresh perspectives, drama, documentary and debate. I'm Hardeep Singh Kohli and it all begins with my programme, Crossing the Border, part of India and Pakistan 2007. Next Monday morning at 9 o'clock.
Will now be